This episode of Pub Talk Live was broadcast on January 11th, 2020, with guest co-host Fran Wild and special guest Rachel Hartman. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the January 11th episode of Pub Talk Live. Happy New Year. This is the live publishing talk show airing the second and fourth Saturday of every month at 9 p.m. Eastern. And I'm your host, Sarah Nicholas. I'm a young adult author, the current managing director of Pitch Wars, and a library event planner. Just a reminder, you can subscribe to reminders via email by clicking on the link in the description so that you don't miss a show. You can also subscribe on YouTube right here. And then you can also follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at Pub Talk Live. If you'd like to support the show, you can find a link to the Patreon near the end of the video description down below. And now I am going to bring on today's guest co-host. Fran Wild's novels and short stories have been finalized for 4 Nebula Awards, a World Fantasy Award, and 2 Hugo Awards, and include her Nebula and Compton Crook winning debut novel, Updraft, its sequels, Cloudbound and Horizon. Her double star debut middle grade novel, Riverland, and the Nebula, Hugo, and Locus nominated novelette, The Jewel in Her Lapidary. Her short stories and nonfiction essays appeared in Asimov's, Tor.com, Nature, and the Washington Post, and the New York Times. Fran is director of the MFA for genre writing at Western Colorado University. So please welcome Fran.
Hi, guys. Hello. Thank you for having me, Sarah.
Thanks so much for coming. Let's see. We have Kelly is here. Kelly says hello.
Hello.
Dee Dee was talking to us on Twitter.
Oh my gosh. Hey, Dee Dee. That's great to see you.
So welcome everyone to the first show of 2020. If you have not yet, make sure you go over to Twitter and vote in our viewer poll today. And the question for today is, what do you primarily use to write first drafts? And we will talk about that at the end when all the results are in. Yeah. All right. So we're going to jump right into news items. Fran, where are you located geographically?
I'm in Philadelphia.
Oh, okay. Oh.
But I teach in Colorado. It's complicated.
But... yeah. I would really like to visit Philadelphia one day. So
you should come. Yeah. I mean, you could come for ALA, which is at the end of the month. I love taking people around the city. It's such a great combination of sort of walkable, accessible grid and great food. And, it's winter, so we won't talk about the driving.
My coworker is from Philly and she talks about the food a lot.
The food is great. Some of my favorite restaurants lately are here.
Cool. All right, so we're going to do just an update on the Romance Writers of America situation that we discussed in the last episode. There have been major changes in the past 2 weeks. The RITAs, which are the major romance book award that are put on by RWA, have been canceled for this year. So the 2020 awards are going to be held with the 2021 contest. And they are going to revamp the contest. Numerous publishers, including Avon, Berkeley, Harlequin, Kensington, St. Martin's, and Entangled, publishers from Situation is a kind word. Yes, it is. Have pulled out of the annual RWA conference. But as of right now, it is still going to happen, theoretically, I guess. And then the big news is that President Damon Swade and Director Carol Ritter have resigned, which is what a lot of people were calling, and there was a recall petition in the works for that. So it's still a mess in summary. Yeah. I don't know what to say about this. I've just been watching and, you know.
I think one of the things that stands out to me, and it's come up on Twitter again today, is just the work, the amount of work that authors of color in particular have done to try and right this ship over many, many months. Mm-hmm. A lot of the focus has gone to Courtney Millen, but there have been many people working both in front of the scenes and behind the scenes that have sort of been overlooked. But I think that's changing now. And a lot of the work that has been done to try and sort of figure this out has been, is being recognized finally,
yeah,
which is good.
Yeah, we'll see what happens next. I think they're having an interim president. They're not appointing a president right away. They're kind of looking to see who's eligible to be president. There are pretty strict rules on who can be president. So it's a short list that they're working with anyway. And so I guess we'll see what happens. And Carol Ritter is apparently staying on for a little while to help with the transition. So... All right.
I am following a lot of people on Twitter who are much smarter than me on this topic.
Yeah, I write romance, but I've been a little I haven't been active in romance for a couple years because I've been focusing on YA. And sorry, I just saw a question and I got distracted.
Yeah.
But I haven't been a member of RWA for a couple years now. And so, but I still know a lot of people in the community. Kelly asked, any thoughts on if it would still help to slash hurt to mention RWA membership when querying? That's a good question. I don't know. So for anyone who's wondering, the reason why you would previously is because it demonstrated kind of like a seriousness and a commitment to your career. If you're querying right now, I don't know. If you're local, if you're active in your local chapter, then I think I would mention that probably. But I don't know about the national membership right now.
I think that the local chapters still have a lot of support, especially, you know,
yeah,
they're, if you're active in them. I have some good friends that work really hard for their local chapters. And
yeah. And some are different than others too. So
yes.
Yeah, as we have been hearing.
Dee is noting that Damon Swade didn't meet the rules exactly. Kelly, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I mean, that was about the number of books that you needed to have published, if I got that right.
Yeah.
Or was it the Chuck Tingle thing? Because the Chuck Tingle thing was kind of surreal and amazing.
Yeah. When Chuck Tingle got involved, I was like, this is just, no one could write this. If you wrote this, your editor would be like, this is unrealistic. This doesn't even make sense.
I was trying to explain this to my husband, who goes, if you follow me on Twitter, I talk about The Chemist a lot, big capital C, and his face as I was describing what was happening, especially with Chuck Tingle, just kind of fell. And he went back to working because he couldn't deal with it anymore.
Yeah, every time when I come in the morning, my coworker, I'm like, you want the latest? She's like, yeah. Yeah, number of books and most recent books published. So they have, it's like 5 books of full length. There's a length limit or minimum published ever. And then one of them has to be published in the last 2 years or something like that. And if you're wondering about the Chuck Tingle thing, basically he had said in an interview that he knew who Chuck Tingle was, and Chuck Tingle was like, no, I don't know him. It was that Mariah Carey gift of like, I don't know her. And if you want to catch up on like everything that's been going on related to this, I am going to have a link in the description later tonight where you can just read up on like every little thing that's happened for this whole thing. So you can get caught up. Because when I say these are the highlights, or I guess the lowlights, there's so much more under the surface here. So we will move on to our next topic.
Earlier this week, and maybe a little bit previous, sci-fi author Elizabeth May and a couple of other authors tweeted that trolls were creating multiple Goodreads accounts impersonating her and other authors on Goodreads in order to harass Patrick S. Tomlinson and leave one-star reviews of his books. Several other science fiction authors, including Kat Rambo, who is former president of CIFWA, and Beth Cato, also reported multiple account creations on Goodreads. This is something that is ongoing. Goodreads has started to sort of take those accounts down, and then more spring up because trolls and the internet. But it's also just a really, really good thing to remember just how easily stuff like this is gamed. And turned against authors. It happens, you know, on Amazon as well, but Goodreads has often been gamed like this. And this is just the latest case because I think turning other authors against it and making their names, turning their names against a particular author is particularly kind of insidious.
Mm-hmm. And there's no, like Goodreads doesn't have any protections to kind of prevent this on the front end.
No, and they should because they're so tied to Amazon and to other things. But I've known of Goodreads librarians prior doing things in the back end to try and protect the system and protect the integrity of the system, and this seems to undermine it completely.
Yeah. Yeah, so just be aware. That's another thing you have to worry about as a publisher. Author. We didn't have enough. So Jake Gyllenhaal's production company announced that it is developing a movie of Fun Home, which is a Tony, in case you're not aware, it's a Tony-winning musical based on Alison Bechdel's memoir. He is also going to be playing Bruce Bechdel, Alison's father. Hopefully it's good, right? When I saw this announcement, I was like, Jake Gyllenhaal, Fun Home, why not? I guess that works.
Right.
It's not the person I would expect, but go for it.
Also, in the last couple weeks, President Barack Obama announced some of his favorite books of 2019. It's a really interesting list. It's a great mix of technology and politics and titles like How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy by Jenny Odell, Trust Exercise by Susan Choi, Trick Mirror, The Topeka School, Say Nothing by Patrick Radin Keefe. And this goes along with a list, and there were some sports things too, but this goes along with a list of favorite books, previous to the best books of the year. And it was great to see Toni Morrison's collected works on there, as well as Ted Chiang's Exhalation, American Spy was on there. So it's a great sort of coherent list of lots of different genres and types of writing as well, which is excellent.
Yeah, there are a lot of different books on that list. I was pleasantly surprised.
I think, at the end of the year, you see lists everywhere and they're fantastic because it gives you a wide swath of reading that's available. Mm-hmm. But this is a president who is a big reader, and it's really kind of refreshing to see these lists come out every year. And it's really nice to know he's still doing them.
Yeah, and it's like a thing he makes a point to do. Like, he created a graphic, and it's nice. The effort is nice.
Thank you for reading.
In case he's watching.
He's watching, you never know.
Yeah. So 1,000 letters that were written over 25 years from T.S. Eliot to Emily Hale were unveiled this week. In 1956, she donated the letters with the agreement that they wouldn't be opened until 50 years after both of them had passed, while Eliot ordered her letters to him destroyed.
He had them burned, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's known that the two are close friends, but many consider her to be his muse and hope these letters will better define their relationship and give insight to Eliot's private life. As of Thursday, students and researchers are able to read the letters at Princeton University Library. And there was also a letter that was released recently from him that was meant to be released right before this happened. That was basically like, I don't know, it was a little wild. Like I didn't sleep with her and we were just friends and it was weird. So I'll leave a link down for that down below as well. So you can,
because I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah. Well, the reason why I know about that is I went to, there's this reading series in town that people write pieces based on the previous month's news. And one of the writers did a piece based on that. So, yeah. She was like, well, I don't know if y'all saw it. Well, she's like, well, considering this crowd, y'all probably saw. but yeah, that was the first I had heard of that one. So
the news and social media has been a fire hose over mm-hmm. the past couple of months. And I've been backing off a little bit cause I can't get my work done and watch it. It becomes a job. But at the same time, that's where all my news comes from. So I can't completely look away. So
it looks like Dee Dee read it.
Yeah.
We were just friends, except one of us, me, was in love with the other one before and during my first marriage. Yeah, so we'll leave a link down below for that so you can make sure and go check that out if you're interested. But then this brought up a conversation I was seeing a lot on my feed. People were asking about these kind of things coming out that were never meant to be made public. And what kind of expectation a writer should have to their private communications and, you know, unpublished work mm-hmm. after their death. And that's something really worth thinking about. And especially now in the digital age when like someone could theoretically pull like every email you've ever written, you know, which is kind of terrifying.
Yeah. Or, you know, my journals, I'm pretty public with my journals. I post a lot of drawings and things, but there are definitely things that where I'm thinking through an issue and I'd like to be able to think through it without also having to think of that second layer of, mm-hmm. you know, I want to be able to have that moment to think on my own without thinking of the fourth wall or whatever.
Yeah, and you, like, you see the writers sometimes that they will donate their papers to, like, a university or a library or something. That's, like, a different thing because they're making that decision. But when someone makes that decision for you, especially in the case of, we talked a couple months ago, of authors who are actively guarded it and actively, like, never wanted it to be made public, you know?
Well, and people make that choice Emily Dickinson is a really great example of that. People make that choice for other people all the time. Her letters were redacted and, you know, changed. And it's not just, you know, in the digital age, can somebody read all your emails, but it's deep fakes and how can you know what is real too? Mm-hmm. And that's hard. There's a huge market. There's always been a huge market for fake letters. And I think that's because people want to get closer to authors. They want to know how things tick, how the interior life works. And that happens with a lot of different public mm-hmm. figures as well. But, you know, as we're going forward into places where they can basically reanimate performers who have passed on and take them out on tour, it gets a little nutty figuring out what's real, what's not.
Yeah, definitely.
And that unfortunately leads into the next news item a little bit, which is I need to take a break because that I don't want it to segue that much. But
yeah,
I'm still thinking about the letters, and I'm thinking about like what you don't necessarily want to know about an author, or what you do want to know, and just, you know. Like Emily Dickinson keeps coming back to mind that, you know, so much was lost because the reverse happened.
Mm-hmm.
The next news item is about a couple of several deaths that hit the book world pretty hard this week. Science fiction author Mike Resnick passed at the age of 77 after being diagnosed with lymphoma last year. Mike is a huge influence on a lot of authors. He was very welcoming and kind to a lot of authors in the industry. He also holds the record for the most Hugo nominations at 37. And there were a lot of memorials on Twitter and Facebook this week about that. Mm-hmm. And also Elizabeth Wurtzel, author of Prozac Nation, died Tuesday at the age of 52 due to breast cancer. Prozac Nation was published when Elizabeth was 27, and that book spurred a new wave in confessional memoir writing. And I've been reading some of Elizabeth Wurtzel's latest stories and essays, and the book that she was working on is supposedly amazing. Her style took a different shift, and I'm really hoping that that comes out. I'd like to see the whole thing, or as much as there is.
And Mike Resnick, he actually has two more books due to come out. Yeah. The first one is coming out in April. So did you know him?
I had one letter from Mike very early on in my career. We crossed paths mostly just through other people.
Okay.
So yeah, I was a student of Nancy Kress's, and I know they were very close.
I know a couple of people who knew him. So
yes.
Very, very sad. Yeah. So switching gears.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard when the industry loses such big lights, and every year you feel that loss more and more. Like for me in particular, last year was very hard because Gardner Dozois died. Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of people that Mike's impact is being felt really hard.
Right now. For sure. Excuse me. I had a cold last week and I'm still kind of recovering a little bit. So, Stephen King and Don Winslow have offered to donate $200,000, 100 each, to a children's hospital if the White House press secretary will hold a press conference, which is, by the way, her job. The last one was more than 300 days ago, and the current press secretary, Stephanie Grisham, has never held one.
What do you do if you're a press secretary with no press conferences?
I think you go on Fox News whenever you want, is what she's mainly doing. Yeah, Stephen King obviously is, and Don as well, have both been outspoken against the current president. And I don't know if, even if they held a press conference, if it would even be, you know, worth $1, let alone $200,000. But the money's going to a children's hospital, so it would be a win either way. That's just like, I feel like Stephen King has like graduated to expert troll level the last couple of years.
And this Stephen is just... King, Dan Rather has been like internet dad. Mark Hamill also, Luke Skywalker has occasionally done, like there are some people that are really speaking out in interesting ways, but this is something else again. I hope they get it.
And Stephanie Grisham's like only response really was to say, well, why can't you just donate, you know, without doing this? And their response was, we donate to things all the time. Yeah. So,
yeah.
But of course she didn't actually address the issue at all.
No.
Yeah. Derailing tactic.
I mean, it's a shame that I would like to see certain things back.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm just shorthanding that and just leaving it there for reasons. So Zora, which is a medium-based publication for women of color named after Zora Neale Hurston, released a list called the Zora Canon, which is 100 greatest books ever written by African-American women. And this is just an amazing list, which is broken out by section. The sections start with, you know, just the fight for humanity, 1859 to 1900, going through, you know, Ada B. Wells and A Rebirth of the Arts from 1924 to 1953. The sections are broken out beautifully. The write-ups are fantastic. There's Zora Neale Hurston in there, of course. There's Anne Petrie, Gwendolyn Brooks. The Civil Rights and Black Power era of 1959 to 1975. There are just so many different aspects to this, and it goes all the way up to and through the 90s and then the 2000s to today, and talks about just a really brilliant era that's happening now with authors like N.K. Jemisin and Jesmyn Ward, which is really, really cool. I love, as a poet, I love seeing things like the collected poems of Lucille Clifton on this list. And one of my former teachers, Rita Dove, Thomason Beulah is cited there. So I got really into looking at this list, and I'm very excited to share it with people. I'm excited to share it with my students when I go back next week, actually.
Yeah, I looked at it, and the ones from like the last, you know, decade or so, obviously, I was aware of, but some of the older ones I had never even heard of before. Yeah. And so it's definitely a good list to take a look at and see if there's a gap in your reading that you would like to fill, you know?
I love that it's broken out and each of the books is given its due with a really nice write-up as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So make sure I'm going to, obviously, with all the other links, for those of you who are tuning in for the first time, about an hour or two after the show ends, I update the video description on YouTube with links of everything that we're talking about, so you can go and read more information about it if you would like. And so that's going to include this link, so you can go and check those out. yeah. So Writer Beware did a roundup of the biggest publishing scams and shady operations from 2019. We talked about them a couple of them earlier last year. But if you're a querying writer, you may want to check out that post so you can do your due diligence and figure out who you need to be avoiding.
Also check out and make sure that you read things like for copyright grabs. There's some contests out there that want everything from you just to submit.
Yeah. I think education is key when you're trying to break it into this industry. And so many people have so much misinformation about different practices and they get taken advantage of because of it. And there are so many presses out there who will tell you this is traditional publishing, this is how it goes, and they're doing things badly. Just like Wednesday night, one of my friends was telling someone else that if your book doesn't sell well at a traditional press, you had to return part of your advance. And I was like, that's not true. Like, if it's a legit publisher, that's just not true at all. And it's because someone had, you know, signed with a predatory press, and this was one of the things they did. And now probably multiple people think that that's what publishers do, you know?
Writer Beware does amazing work and catches a lot of flack for it, too.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do a lot of great work. I'm glad that they're there. And I'm glad that they have that ability to kind of speak out sometimes when writers are a little too afraid for good reasons to you know, go public with information. So you had two things that you wanted to share with people, so I'll let you talk about them really quick, and we'll make sure to include those in the links below. They're like resources for writers, right?
Yeah, I do this every year. It's not technically a news item, but it's just super useful for writers of all different genres, but specifically sci-fi and horror and fantasy. Writer and editor Christy Yant has for many years published an Excel spreadsheet that tracks words and word counts. And as you put them in, as the numbers go higher, the colors change, which is great motivation, actually. There's great quotes. There's sort of a career bingo game in there that's fantastic. And she put her 2020 version up of the word count tracking Excel sheet last week. And thank you, Christy, for doing this. It has been such a huge motivator for years. And then also on Twitter, this has been getting a lot of play. Author Kate Dollarhide drew a really great comparison between the perception of an author's skill, our own perception of it, which is, and the growth of skills for writers. And it's interesting because she's exactly right. You feel like you're just, you know, really circling the drain on your writing as your skill level is increasing. So it's great to see that. And I just wanted to point it out as something, you know, in the middle of all of this other news that's kind of hard to hear and kind of a downer, it's great to see something like that.
Yeah, I'm going to check out that the chat word goal or word count tracking sheet.
It's amazing.
I'm about to start a new book in a couple weeks. So,
I mean, not only does it tell you how many words you've written a month, but it'll tabulate the total for the year, and you can see, you know, where if you, you know, don't forget to put them in high. But if you, you know, if you do it pretty regularly, if you make it like, you know, feeding goldfish, you just put your word count in at the end of the day. It gives you a really good metric for how you're doing over the course of a year or how you go about writing a project. Even if you know that you're going to be, you know, working on a book for a certain number of months and then working on short stories, you can see sort of your pace at different times, which cool. I have this, I've been keeping these since Christy started this in 2015 or 2014, I think. So I have data going back 5 years now.
Very nice. The only time I really track my word count is when I'm doing it now. But I have such an analytical brain, it would probably help me to have the numbers in front of me.
I'm such a gamer and it's terrible, but I, you know, that's, if I get in the zone, then it's fine. I can write for as long as I need to, but some days I just have to sit down and write 500 words. Mm-hmm. And if I can put that 500 words somewhere and be accountable for it, like in a word tracker, then I know I've done it. And sometimes it's just really hard to get going. So you need that extra help.
Yeah, I did see last year, I saw this like goal setting method that really helped me last year. I was struggling to finish this book. And the idea is that you set a goal for yourself that's so ridiculously small that mm-hmm. like you would be embarrassed to tell anyone that was your goal, you know? But then it's so easy to hit, you know, that you're like, well, you know, if my goal is like 20 words a day, which is something that's, you know, no one would have a goal for 20 words a day that was actually trying to write a book. But if your goal is 20 words a day and on the days when you're just not feeling it at all, you can write out 20 words, you know? Right. And a lot of times once you get started, you've, you know, overcome that hurdle of just getting started and then you get more. So.
Exactly. It's definitely, for me, it's a problem of, when I started teaching again, I tend towards putting all my effort into other people's things and students definitely get my focus. So I was doing fine keeping track of my words until I hit the point where I had to grade. And I don't, if you're my student, just cover your ears. I hate grading. I hate it. I hate it. Grading is hard. I do so many like narrative comments on papers and feedback on things, but grading is just the devil. And and I stopped writing during that week. I didn't even do my 500 words. So getting back into that is really important because I'd like to keep teaching, but I have to write first. That's my primary. And so yeah. I have to figure out how to get the grading component that comes in at the end, in the middle and the end of the semester when the big papers drop to fit with what I'm working on otherwise. But I did finish a novel while I was teaching last semester, so I think I'm okay.
Yeah. All right. Did you want to talk about ALA since it's coming up?
I think because we're sort of coming to the end of okay. the news period, just ALA is coming to Philadelphia, and I'm hoping that everybody who comes by, you know, gives Philly a big wave. There is a kidlit group in town called Low Groggery that Catherine Locke and Alexander London help coordinate, and they've sort of issued if you're in town for the ALA conference and you're in town on Thursday, give them a shout. There's going to be sort of a meetup, which happens every month. They've done this amazing thing where they've been sort of regrouping the kidlit writers in Philadelphia, and they're so good at it. So thanks, Katie. Thanks, Alan.
Yeah, and usually there's like news items that come out of that, so we might be discussing some of the things that come out of it.
I think I saw a little something go past my screen this morning about something that ALA was doing, but I can't be sure what that was. Mm-hmm. So.
All right, well, we are ready to bring on our special guest for the evening. Our special guest tonight is Rachel Hartman. Rachel was born in Kentucky, but has lived a variety of places, including Chicago, Philadelphia, St. Louis, England, and Japan. She has a BA in comparative literature, although she insists it should have been a BS because her undergraduate thesis was called Paradox and Parody in Don Quixote and the Satires of Lucian. She eschewed graduate school in favor of drawing comic books. She now lives in Vancouver with her family, their Whippet, which is a dog, for those who don't know, and a talking frog and salamander. So please welcome to the show, Rachel Hartman. Hey. Hi, Rachel. How are you doing? Uh-oh.
Aha.
Smart. Yeah. Ah. Got it.
Good. Glad to be here.
And, is this thing on?
Yeah, it's never really on. just want you to realize that I'm here in Canada, which mm-hmm. is vast and freezing and blank. You'll notice, I don't know if you probably didn't see this because you're not Canadian and you wouldn't trigger your notice, but the New York Times tweeted about how Harry and Meghan are moving here.
Yes.
And that mm-hmm. Canadians who live in this vast, blank, cold wilderness are super excited because the Royals are going to add razzle dazzle to our humdrum existence. And Canadians have been going off on that all day. It's very funny if you want to go look it up.
Oh, that's why somebody was tweeting about their shoes and how fabulous their shoes were.
Yes. Just look up razzle dazzle on Twitter. And that was the literal phrase. So yeah.
Oh, wow.
And anyway, yeah, but see, I got these headphones with the you know, the glowing lights. So I figured yes. we'd dazzle and the razzle here.
Well, I have returned to my space background. So mm. I had a festive holiday background last month.
Okay.
So I'm back
Space
home.
Is festive.
And if you're a longtime watcher of the show, you might notice that I got a new camera because my old camera wouldn't color balance and it made me like yellow. Well, it's just my laptop camera. So yeah, I'm back to the space background and I don't look yellow. So
that's pretty cool. Also, I feel like I've got a color thing going on, like it's sort of reddish and then it's sort of,
I've got a sky yeah. bison. That's all I got. And a heron, a friend of mine.
Yay.
Everybody, I go to meetings like this cause mm-hmm. I have to go mm-hmm. like to meet online and people like, is that a, What is that behind you? Appa. You don't know Appa?
Yeah. Great. Hey, before I forget, before we move on too much from what you were just talking about, ALA Midwinter is also where they give out the Youth Media Awards.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. I want to give a shout out because most of the awards, they call you the morning of, you know, and wake you up and, you know, because they don't want spoilers. But the Morris Award, which is the award for the debut novel, tells in advance who the shortlist is.
Oh, okay.
And one of the people on the shortlist is my co-Vancouverite and friend Nafisa Saad for her book, The Candle and the Flame, which I blurbed. I was like, I knew I blurbed it for a reason. It's really good. I encourage people to read it. And I mean, there's other awesome books on the list as well, but that's the one I know and that's the one I'm rooting for. So nice. I just wanted to shout out to her and, you know. Put a little plug in.
Yeah, I listened to it on audio. It's good.
Yeah, yeah. It's about a fictional Silk Road where, it's wonderful. Anyway, carry on. Sorry.
You're good. In the last episode of Pup Talk Live, I had Heidi Heilig on. And when she heard that you were going to be on next, Rachel, she asked me to ask you how you make your book so good.
Uh-oh.
So I have translated that. And so what I'm going to ask you is what are some of the things that you think have contributed most to your writing and the development of yourself as an author?
Wow. Okay. Well, I think some of it simply is that I stubbornly insist on taking a lot of time. I say that as if I were some sort of diva and it was my choice, really. But in fact, I can't actually write faster than I do. I have been really fortunate to have an editor and, you know, the folks at Random House who are willing to let me take the time that I take. Partly they realize there's no hurrying me up. But the books get written multiple times. I just, in fact, this week got editorial notes on about the fourth draft of the sequel of Tess the Road. And
it's so good, I did guys. Have it's so good. Tiny, I've seen it. It's awesome.
I had a tiny baby author meltdown, however, because I was like, you know what? I've written this so many times and I was feeling a little burned out. But I have since done some heavy outlining and realized, okay, you know, there are places it can be better. So
okay. Yay.
I I hate that.
It takes 3 days. It takes like 3 days that you get the letter, and no matter how much you love your editor, you just kind of have to put it down and go clean something a lot.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then you come back and you look at it and you maybe read like a couple sentences and you're like, oh, okay, you're still wrong. And then you go away and eventually you come back and you realize that they're really smart and good at what they do and they weren't trying to wound you mortally. And it takes a while.
But. Yeah, no, it does. It does. And there are a few places where he was wrong, but sometimes being mad at your editor a little bit and realizing that, and it brings out this kind of impulse of, I'll show him, you know, and so his suggestion was terrible, but I had this other idea and off I go, you know, so, And so can I just say, and wave at Heidi through space and time here, but I really thank you for phrasing the question that what makes your book so good, because I do sometimes just lament that I can't write faster, you know, and I see all these good books that seem to be coming out much faster than mine. And I get really jealous and frustrated and they just, this is the process and this is what it takes for me personally. So, I think of my brain as sort of a mulch pile, which is not a romantic image perhaps, but stuff keeps accumulating and I have to turn it over and it has to rot and it takes the time it takes, you know, and that's
quit describing what our room looked like after the nebula.
Hey,
Rachel and I roomed together occasionally. We were not the neatest.
Oh,
well. What do you mean neat? We were neat in the sense of like we're super neato. So speak for yourself, lady. But yes, all right. Tidiness, no, perhaps not. But again, you know that I pretend that's my creative process too. You know, a place for everything and everything on the floor. How did we get to my housekeeping? I don't know.
All right. Editor letters, cleaning.
Full circle.
Totally logical.
But everything I read, everything I experience, everything I do goes into the hopper, and that I really feel like it takes time to ferment, and it just, you know, but I make use of lots of different things from just every unexpected angle. And sometimes I'll suddenly be interested in something. I don't know why. And I call that a brain grab, because it's like my brain is like, I want the thing. And I don't understand why, but I just follow it wherever it goes. It usually turns out to be something that I needed for the book that I didn't know I needed, but my brain is smarter than I am and my brain knew. And so one example, actually this week, one of the things—
I was gonna say, can you tell us an example?
Yeah, I can tell you one example here, because Fran talked to me earlier in the week when I was still very sad about my notes. And I was, you know, flipping through Netflix as one does, and there's a documentary about Mr. Rogers. It's not, you know, there's the Tom Hanks movie. I don't even know if that's out yet. I wasn't interested at all, but suddenly there was a documentary a couple years ago with actual footage of Mr. Rogers. And suddenly I was like, Mr. Rogers. And I watched it and there was one line in there and I didn't know it was giving good. And it hit me and I was like, oh, thank you. And then you know, but my brain was like, you need to watch this right now.
Really, really, you're gonna do that thing where you like fill this up and then you're not gonna give us the line?
Honestly, the line was about Tikkun Olam. I'm not sure I even say that right, but you know the concept, the repair of the world. And he was talking about all the things one does that are part of that. And he listed just like this whole, I don't even remember all the things he listed, but all this whole thing. And some of them were so small. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, it just suddenly, like a thing clicked that there were things in the book that were small, but they were still contributing to the bigger. Anyway, it made me feel better.
All right.
So another one, the one that I like giving them an example of the most is when I was writing on Shadow Scale, because this one was really, really strange, is I suddenly decided I needed to learn overtone singing. And I didn't know why, but I was just, it was the only thing I was interested in. And so I worked and worked until I could do it. And then I realized that it was a metaphor for the book. Mm-hmm. And that I thought, what I thought was the principal tone of the book was in fact an overtone. I had to get one level below that to write the real book, which was down here. Anyway, so yeah. So maybe the real answer is how do you write by being very strange. But just noticing the weird things that your brain wants, you know, and following them where they lead, and that again takes time. So.
Well, and there's absolutely, you know, the book takes as much time as it takes, and your books are wonderful. You know how I feel about Tess.
I do. I feel about that way about her too.
But, you know, sometimes you write a book and it feels right, and then you need to completely rewrite it from the other perspective just to get that different side of it. And then you write it again to get the voice. Mm-hmm. And you know, I wish I could write one draft clean and be done, but that's not how I do it.
Well, what I tell my students, and this is just a philosophical attitude I try to have toward it all, is that writing is never wasted, right? Mm-hmm. And even if you write a thing and it doesn't end up in the book, and it doesn't even seem related to the book necessarily, but you have learned something important doing it. And so, you know, that writing is never wasted. And also just, you know, be patient with yourself. And yeah, I'm learning a lot from my students. Is that, you find this, Fran, that your students teach you all this stuff and you're like, oh.
All the time. And I that's one of the great, wonderful things about teaching is, especially in graduate school, is that you really, it is a give and take, and it is part of the process to just you know, have discussions where everybody pitches in and brings stuff to the table. So yes, definitely. You know, describing my process to them and watching them sort of go sideways is also a little bit alarming sometimes. But I mean, I was out in LA in December talking to Nello Hopkinson, and she was talking about her process and her teaching and her pedagogy as well. And just the way that she relates to her students is very similar in a way to reading a Nello Hopkinson's story. You feel like she's in the room with you, just kind of beaming at you. And and you know, and if you make a wrong turn, she'll just be, no, that is not it. Come back, read this again. And I can't imagine how wonderful it would be to take a class with her, because it's just such a generous outlook. But I think, you know, she really does learn a lot as she goes too. She loves teaching new things for that reason. So that was cool. That was, it was great talking to her.
Well, something that came into focus for me this last term was I had a couple students who clearly were starting from theme, which is not usual, right? Usually people will start with a character or plot. Sometimes it's a setting, which is how I think of myself as a setting oriented person. But these people were starting with theme. And I said to them, oh, wow, you know, okay. That is the hardest place to start.
Yeah,
I realized as I was telling this though, I realized that actually is where I always start.
For the second book. Yeah.
Yeah. And I hadn't thought of myself doing that, but it is. I was able to recognize it. And I was like, oh, I'm so sad for you. And yet I'm not, but I am. And then, but then talking to them, I was able to understand some of the strategies that I've come up with for doing that, you know, which is that you have this, the problem with starting with theme, you're walking down the street and the theme hits you really big and you're just like, oh, I solved life. I know everything. The book is done, except it's not done at all. You haven't written anything.
Never done.
No, no.
Never really done, is it?
And so, you know, you gotta like hug and kiss your theme and cuddle it and then put it away and look at it as much as you possibly can. And it will still be there. It will still be in everything. But you know, if you, because you can just sit there gazing admiringly at it and loving it and not going forward at all. So that was a little sobering to realize about myself. I hadn't understood that, but there you go. So, we live and learn, I guess.
So we have assembled some questions for you.
Oh, actual questions. Golly, I've been talking and you've already gotten the questions. Okay.
This one might sound familiar. If you could assign astrological signs to your main characters, who would be born under what star and why?
Oh, no.
It was too good. It was too good. We were talking about this before.
We were talking about that before, and you were telling me, and here's the problem.
I know, but I don't know
anything about astrology, like nothing.
Me neither. Almost
nothing. Okay. And so you said Cancer, and I knew Cancers were emotional, and I am supposedly a Cancer. Who knew?
We're both Cancer. So Rachel and I are birthday.
That's true. I don't know if everyone realized that.
We share a birthday year and a birthday date. So yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Secret twins. but I haven't done a study of this. So you thought Tess is,
Tess is definitely you.
I'm disappointing you. Tess is Cancer. You were thinking Serafina was Libra?
Yes.
Okay. I almost said Virgo. I don't know the difference. I don't know what's going on.
Very balanced, very logical. Everything gets weighed before she says anything
Okay. That makes sense. That makes sense. So
I'm a Libra, so.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We'll see. She's
careful and thoughtful. Meanwhile, like, you know. Yes.
Measured. We're just here like, wah!
Cool.
Other than that, I don't know what anyone would be, and I'm really sorry.
Your answer. Okay. That was the only quiz. There's nothing.
Okay. Okay.
Anything like rough or anything.
Failing.
Like that. Oh, fine. Sarah's got the real questions.
No. Can we talk a little bit about the gender-related themes in your books?
Sure. We can.
I loved the exploration of gender, especially in like Tess. And I know you also did a blog post. You've learned a little bit about gender expression and harmful tropes since writing Serafina as well. Mm-hmm. What kind of work did you do to kind of explore and learn more about gender expression?
Reading, you know, and looking things up online and learning all the different, there's so many different gradations of everything now. It's really interesting to me. I feel like kids today are so lucky. Like they get to choose from this entire smorgasbord of things to be. And that's really great, you know? But a lot of it too, I think, is from just inner exploration as well, and coming to understand what gender actually means to me, and how I experience it, and what, you know, and then discussing that with trans friends, with other people, with non-binary friends, and trying to really get, you know, a grasp on what it actually means and the degree to which it is fluid, the degree to which it means anything, the degree to which I secretly believe my hair is actually, you know, 80s rocker dude hair. So, you know, like, and what are all the nuances and how, you know, how can you find your own place and how do the characters find their place? And so actually in this next book, I have a non-binary character. I have multiple perspectives, which I've never done before, but this book is too big to fit in one brain. So we need a lot of brains. And one of the characters is non-binary and is sort of, grumpy at everyone as a result. But
wait, really, so one of your main characters is me?
Is what?
Is me?
Well,
grumpy at everyone.
They are a bit grumpy at everyone, but that alleviates over time too, as you know, people come to understand each other, which is nice. So. So that's been really interesting, and figuring out which parts of me are in that character, you know, which parts of me intersect, which parts of me are different, which parts of me, you know, and so that has been really interesting to me, just on a, I feel like nine, this is the other thing I didn't mention with the whole, like, what do I do to write? A lot of what I write is in fact processing of my own stuff. And so this has been a process of processing, and a big, you know, learning experience, and really interesting and enjoyable for me. So I hope it comes out, you know, in the final book that we're all, it all works out and everyone is intrigued and I don't fall on my face. But then again, if I fall on my face, I will have learned something too.
Not gonna happen. It's already super good. So.
All right.
And all right. I'm not just saying that because there's boats in there.
Oh. Mm.
She likes the boat. Yeah, she's my boat.
I like the boat.
My boat friends at it then.
I got to see an early draft. I mean, okay. I'm hoping I get to see another draft.
Yes, cool. You will. Yay. You will.
Make sure that happens. Well, like, you have my email address now, so.
Yeah. Oh. Okay. We'll bear that in mind.
We do have a question from a viewer I wanted to pop in. Yeah. Daniel said, you say theme is not the best place to start when creating a concept of a book, but what would you say is the best last thing to think out?
Ah, well, all right. Let me kind of put a little more nuance on that. When I say theme is not the best place to start, what I mean is theme is the hardest place to start, because it's hard. You have to set theme aside. If you shove theme in there, everybody sees it and everybody says, wow, quit sticking your theme down my throat. And they get annoyed. And so I think ideally theme is something that one should not be worrying about until late stages, because what I would say for me, ideal is if you can write the story, a draft or two, then you go in and you look and see what the themes are that you've already put in there. Because you will put themes in there. All a theme really is what are your preoccupations, right? The things that your brain is doing. You think you're right telling an exciting adventure tale. You are not. You are talking about your evil ex-boyfriend, or you are talking about, you know what I'm saying? There's something you're talking about that you're not intending to talk about, that you think you've cleverly disguised, but you know, you're wearing a mask that looks like your own face at the end of the day. And so you go in then and you look and you see where your themes are, and then you can draw them out and expand that. They're already there. Like, you don't have to worry about them. So the reason themes are hard, again, that it's a hard place to start is because it's not the nuts and bolts of the story. You have to find something else to fall in love with. And it can be character, it can be setting, it can be plot. I say plot last because plot is the thing I'm never, ever, ever in love with ever. So, but you need it. You need it. So, but you know, find the other thing, find the other things that will carry you through to get the work done. Like, theme is like living in lotus land. You are eating the lovely theme lotus fruit and you're not moving forward. You're just kind of basking in it. And so I don't know if that makes sense. Is that a sensible answer? Sort of, maybe.
Yeah. Right. And I think also it's different for kind of everyone, right?
Absolutely.
Like, everyone kind of starts at a different spot.
That's the thing. I have to tell you, this is my secret crackpot theory of writing at the moment, which is that writers, you know, they're back in my day, we learned, you know, four elements of fiction, right? Which was theme, setting, character, plot. And not coincidentally, or probably completely coincidentally, in the Myers-Briggs test, which is my
your astrology.
Zodiac, my zodiac, the okay. Myers-Briggs test, okay. The middle letters, right, which can be N, F, T, or S, right? There are four of those as well. And those each actually kind of correspond to one of the elements of fiction, that intuition corresponds to theme, right? And feeling corresponds to character. And S, which is like real world sensory stuff, corresponds to setting. And the other one, what was it? Thinking corresponds to plot. It's not really, this is a big lie, but it's interesting to think about. And so what I was trying to do with my students this time, and I think they all thought I was nuts, and yet I was excited about this, is that, okay, because everybody has all of those, even though on the Myers-Briggs, you have to sort out and pretend you only have two, but those two are your strengths, and the other two are your shadow side. And so if you were very strong on one of these things, my guess was that would also be the corresponding element of fiction that would just come to you naturally. I don't know that that's the case. There is no scientific basis for that. It's astrology again.
But the N one again?
N is intuition. And that for me, I'm like off the charts. Intuition is imagination. Mm-hmm. I mean, it corresponds roughly to that, but it also corresponds to synthesis, right?
Yeah.
That it's when you have a lot, like I've talked about my process, put all the stuff in the hopper, don't think about it, but your brain is thinking about it mm-hmm. all the time. And then it comes like, burps up this idea and you're like, where did that come from? I don't remember thinking about that. Well, theme is like that too. Mm-hmm. You don't have to think about it. It's there. And so you're thinking about it without being conscious of thinking about it. And so this is a long, elaborate way of saying, I think different writers write are going to start in different places. I think there are people that start with plot and I envy them so badly. You know, because it just seems like that would be an easy place to start. Maybe it's not. You know, I would love to talk to someone about that someday.
My problem with the Myers-Briggs is I keep wanting to make the letters spell something, so I always get distracted. I also want to know now what Serafina is and what Tess is on the Myers-Briggs. Oh, crap.
Now, see, I haven't thought that through. Okay. Hold on though. I think Serafina would definitely be Serafina would probably be an INTJ. And I think Tess would probably be an ENFP.
That makes very good. He's just all like, you know.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
All on the surface. That makes sense.
So
an end. It's like an ant, but with more. Mm. Anyway, I told you I was going to do that. Dee's got a really nice point.
Oh,
I'm reminded of Yoon Ha Lee saying, "I didn't mean to write a trans book about his book in which a man literally exists in the body of a woman."
This is in the Hex Arcade trilogy that you mm-hmm. had wrote, and he's these are amazing books, but they've got different lives existing mm-hmm. in different layers.
Mm-hmm. I'll have to look those up. I have not read
it. Tamara.
Tamara made it.
Let's see, now that I've got you profiling your own character.
right.
I would like to know if you have any rituals or habits that help you get started on a writing process or that help you keep going.
That's an interesting question. I sometimes in the morning, if I'm having trouble, settling down, cause I do have trouble settling down and, you know, I can always find something else I need to do. I will meditate sometimes for about 10 minutes. And I always feel weird talking about that because I feel like it sounds sort of pretentious or something, but and I don't have I've never taken a class. I don't have a system. I read the beginning of a book on Buddhist meditation one time and got as far as like the first chapter wherein they said, okay, have a thing that you think, you let go of your thoughts when they come up. And if you can't get your brain to shut up, have a sentence that you say. And here's one sentence. And the sentence was, only death is certain. And I use that and I have never needed another sentence. I really like that sentence. it makes me feel good about, because the things that are getting me all riled up are all the everything, right? And you're saying to yourself, only death is certain. And then you're like, oh, that's true. And so while I'm sitting there for 10 minutes and I think of my thoughts floating away in bubbles, and then I think of my neurons and I pretend I'm combing them like my hair. I'm combing them and getting them all straight in order. And then I say only death is certain if I get too distracted. And then I'm settled down and I can sit and write for time. And it's, you know, although I've skipped a thing, which is actually I write first thing in the morning too. And I don't have to meditate then because I still have a sleep. And so my inner editor sleeps in, and that is actually when I have all my best ideas, because things that I would not let myself get away with the rest of the day just come then. I don't say no. I just do them. Other than that, I'm trying to think. I make sure.
I'm so glad I asked that question, but now I'm going to be like neuron combing.
Well, yeah, I envision that. I'm like, yeah, my brain is all tangled. I'm just like combing it down.
Like, what does your hairbrush look like after you do that?
Yes. Wow.
Sarah's like, focus. Come on.
I meditate to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have a similar thing where I just will stay up all night just thinking about things.
Mm-hmm.
But I was in fifth grade, and my teacher played this like guided meditation tape, and that was my first experience with meditation. Mm-hmm. And they had you imagine a blank space with a colored ball of light.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the focus of the meditation. And usually I can meditate fine, but sometimes if I'm just like really distracted and like thoughts are going everywhere, I still use that. Even I learned it when I was like 12, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think if you have something that works.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Tamara said, I'm curious to see how many writers listen to music while writing. I myself will listen to a certain type of music to help me feel the scene, then switch it off. Do either of you listen to music?
I do.
Yeah,
I do.
My style is weird, though.
I was going to say, what kind of music?
I usually pick one song that I listen to for the entirety of the writing project, and I just put it on a loop. I have a real jerk brain. I have the kind of brain that's like, oh, let's do this. Or, hey, remember that dumb thing that you said in fourth grade? Let's think about that a little bit right now. And then, you know, it'll throw me out. So when I play, I was a programmer for a while before, I started writing full time, and it's an old programmer trick that you can throw yourself kind of in a fugue state. If you put the same song on a loop, it has to be a specific kind of song. It can't be like too much, but usually if I play it long enough, I will forget that it's even playing. And the minute I hear that song, I know it's time to work. Mm-hmm. So every book pretty much has one song that is completely associated with it. And I can never play that song again because then I...
I do sort of a similar... I will put a song on endless repeat and just like suck the joy out of it. It's not usually one song per project. I don't think that would work for me because I take too long writing these things.
Somebody asked me what the songs were for the Bone Universe series, and I know what they are, and it's kind of sometimes it's kind of embarrassing thinking about, because one of them was the Magnificat, Box Magnificat, which worked really well, and some of Carmina Burana as well was for Updraft, but Cloudbound was Glittering Clouds, Imogene Heap. And I just, that song will still make me hyper just getting back into it. I wrote that book twice.
Yeah, actually my most recent thing I've been listening to on endless repeat is Ne Iriscaris Domine by William Byrd, which translates from the Latin as don't be mad, God. And it is the most beautiful song in the world. And I think I could listen to it forever and not be tired of it, actually. Other than that, previous books like Irla O'Leonard gets frequent rotation for me. I don't know if you know who he is. He's an Irish vocalist who sang with a band called Afro-Celt Song System for a while.
Yes, I know that band.
Yeah, well, the floaty Irish voice that was sometimes in, I don't know if it was, I don't know, I don't listen to that band. I listen to his solo works. He sings Shannos, which is literally means old style. It's Irish traditional singing that was traditionally a cappella, just a solo voice. And so that one voice has to carry like all this grief because it's Irish music, right? And it's just, you know, it's not a reel. It's the other Irish music, the really sad stuff. And his voice is just perfect for it. And he, on his solo works, though, he does have instruments in the background that he has put in there, and they're sort of atmospheric a lot of times. But that stuff is, yeah, I can listen to that forever also.
Now I want to hear it. I want links.
Irla, well, I'll send you some links to Irla. Irla's my man.
You haven't mentioned Rush yet.
Rush. Oh, I do also listen to Rush and other prog rock. Prog rock is a bit, is also in high circulation, but she's trying to make me cry.
No, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry.
It is true.
It's terrible.
Sad about that. Actually, Canada's sad about a bunch of things right now, but Neil Peart is one. So
lacking in razzle dazzle and sad at the same time.
Yes.
And Fran actually did have that question before.
It's true.
Yeah.
About what?
Why do you like Rush? Because
why do I like Rush?
It wasn't. I mean, you were in Philadelphia. You've been exposed to the fact that Jethro Tull is the.
Oh, I like Jethro Tull. I mean, look. Here's the thing. I was raised on classical music, and I did not understand the rock and roll. It sounded like alien noises to me. But then I married this physicist, and physicists like prog rock because it has math in it, and prog rock also has classical music in it, and so that actually was an in for me. And so I started, Yes was the first band that really moved me, of a prog rock band, but Jethro Tull also, because it had the folk influence and the flute, and so those were two that they were accessible to me in a way that ordinary rock music wasn't. Rush has an interesting, maybe it's only interesting to me, but the story about Rush is I, one by one, was liking all these bands of Scots. And I was like, fine, but I will never like Rush because Geddy Lee sounds like someone is strangling him. And and so we moved to Canada. I managed to avoid Rush forever. We moved to Canada. And one day I'm folding laundry and CBC is on and there's a concert. And there are these three little nerds up there rocking out. And I'm watching them going, aren't they the cutest? Who are these guys? These are my people, clearly. And Scott starts laughing his head off. And he's like, it's Rush, dummy. I was like, darn it. And I had to rethink my entire philosophy of life. And I listened to all Rush. And I was like, yeah, okay. All right, we're good. Yeah.
All right. We've gone a little over, but I just kinda, I've been enjoying it. So I'm just like, talking, it's fine. But there is one question I have to ask you, because I ask every single guest, and it is a little difficult question, so feel free to take like a second to think about it. But it's, what is the most important book you've ever read and why?
The most important book I've ever read?
Yes, yeah.
Important to me, or
you can important? Yeah, you can define it however you want.
Okay, hang on.
Yeah.
She has to comb the neurons. Neuron combing.
Yes.
There's a lot of different options. But I'm going to say it is Finn Family Moomin Troll. The reason being that was the book that taught me to read. Mm. My mother had read it out loud to me once, and I wanted her to read it out loud to me again, and she would not. Because she thought it was creepy. And so I had to teach myself to read so I could read it. And I did. And I read it a bunch of times. And I remembered it being like this thick. Apparently it's not. It's only as a kid. We had some different version of it. But that to me is the most important book in the world. And I think it taught me that that books could go absolutely anywhere and that they could be as dark and as weird and as idiosyncratic as you could possibly make them and still be the most beautiful thing you ever saw. So I don't know. Ask me again tomorrow. I'll tell you
the answer. Didi said, can I steal this question for author interviews? Sure, I guess. I've been asking people this for years, but only on the show am I able to do it like regularly now. So I like it. I always like to hear people's answers. Sometimes I'm like, oh, I need to get that book. And sometimes I'm like, I can do without it, but that's fine. All right. Well,
what's your most important book?
Mine?
Yes.
I knew someone would ask me this question eventually.
Am I the first person to ask you that question?
You are. No, you are. Yeah.
I should have warned you about Fran. Fran,
I know. I know. Mine also changes from like day to day. But a lot of times I think about, oh my God, what's the author's name? The book was Heartlight. And I can't remember the author's name. T something. It's like initials. But I had read it when I was in very young, like in fourth grade or something. And I remember like kind of being enamored by it. But also it was the first time that I realized that that books were written by people and made up by people. And
it's Kate Gordon who was writing as T.A. Barron.
Yes, T.A. Barron.
I have a Google.
Yeah. I was like, I have a very small screen and I have to have so many windows on it that I like try not to touch it. And I remember I told one of my good friends in college about it, and I didn't even remember the title. I had remembered like some of the scenes, and TD got it too. And I had described it to my friend, and I remember just like I almost remembered it like it was a dream, you know, like I couldn't really remember a lot about it. And my friend actually found it and figured out what it was and then gave it to me for Christmas.
Oh.
Aww.
Yeah. So he set the standard for gifts forever. That's usually the answer.
Years later and did it hold up?
I was in college.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that would just make me fall completely and crying.
Yeah. I'm not a crier, but it did touch me. I read parts of it and I wasn't quite as enthralled as I was when I was.
Well, sure, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. When I graduated from university, the first thing I did, and this is again was a brain grab, I think, was I reread all of Lloyd Alexander's Paradigm books. And those were way thinner and more insubstantial. I mean, I remembered those as being like huge and full of world. And I was like, wow, well, this is very interesting. So those could have been.
And then you practiced pronouncing Fred O'Fleur and.
Yeah.
You met him though. You met Lloyd Alexander.
Yeah.
So jealous.
Oh. Yeah. No, he was amazing.
Probably a story for another time.
Yeah, I was going to say, we could talk all night, Sarah.
I know.
That's the secret.
I was thinking about it. I was like, this may go on because we did the tech test earlier, Fran and I earlier this week, and we ended up talking for like almost 30 minutes. And I was like, oh, this is how the show is going to go this week. That's fine.
I mean, we made plans for lunch when we were in Orlando. It was
fun. That's great.
And basically, also, you were there when Sarah had to cut me off right before we went live. She's like, all right, Fran.
Yeah. I was like, 20 seconds, got to stop.
You know, like, right in the middle of a sentence about my hair.
All right. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for joining us.
You're
it was
welcome.
A pleasure.
It's really fun. Really fun.
Great. I was like so happy when you agreed to come on. I've just been so pleasantly surprised by like pretty much everyone that I've really wanted in the show has said yes. So I've been really lucky and you're one of my favorite authors. So I'm just like thrilled that I get to interview you.
I didn't just ruin that somehow.
No.
Well, good.
All right. Yeah. And so just can you let us know, like, if you have anything coming up that you want to let people know about, where they can find you online, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Great.
You mean now, like,
yes,
with words, yeah, with my face. Okay.
This is the self-promotion part of the
self-promotion part. Yeah.
Love this part.
I am working really hard, actually, and it's taking all my brain to work on the sequel to Tess of the Road. It is tentatively called Tess of the Sea. We may change that, although I don't know. Now my editor's thinking maybe we won't. I don't know. it will probably not come out this year, however. Mm-hmm. It will probably come out next year, I think. Which makes sense because all my books have been 3 years apart. No matter how hard I try, they're just 3 years apart. And that's how it is. So that's it. Something to look forward to. As for other promotional anything, I don't think I have like any big plans. So if you want to find me, I'm often on Twitter tweeting about my dog or my fungus or my enormous child who I can hear his music upstairs. I did tell him 7:15 and it came on pretty promptly. but I'm, you know, I'm a friendly person and happy to, you know, engage with folks and say hi. So
yeah. And you can find all of, her website and her Twitter, in the description down below. It's there now. So, if you want to check her out, make sure you go and find that. So, well, Rachel, have a good night. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, Rachel.
Always lovely to see you, friend.
See you later. Mwah.
That was fun. Yeah, we only got through like half of our interview questions.
I know, we had such smart questions and no one ever seen them. It's terrible.
Sorry. I don't regret it at all.
Yeah. Regret nothing.
Yes. So a couple of things. We're going to do the audiobook of the week, which is a feature that I decided to add to the show because I love audiobooks and it goes no deeper than that. So the audiobook of the week for this week. So if you've been watching before, you know, I was a judge for the Audies at the end of last year. And so there was like 3 months where I listened to all audiobooks that I'm not allowed to talk about. And so I'm finally like kind of catching up. And so this is one that came out in September, but like everyone was talking about it. And so I had to get it. And I,
Great.
I'm actually listening to it right now. So it's Gideon the Ninth by Tamsin Muir.
Yeah.
Muir? Yeah. Okay, good. I just realized I was like, that's a short name, but I'm not entirely sure how to say it. Yeah, I'm not even completely done. I'm like at the very end right now, but
this is like necromancy in space.
Yeah, so there's a quote here from Charles Strauss, which like really sums it up really well. Lesbian necromancers explore a haunted gothic palace in space. So perfect. Yeah, I know. I saw that and I was like, That's a perfect, very short summary. But it's narrated by Maura Quirk, who I love. She narrated all of Gail Carriger's Finishing School series.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And those are just like a delight to listen to. And so super glad, yeah, to have her in my ears again. yeah, so I'm really enjoying this. So I just realized I can't see the comments. Okay, anymore. I got it back. Yeah, so make sure to check it out. Listen to it on audio if that's your thing. If not, a lot of people enjoyed it. Let's see. Didi said terrific book and specifically terrific audiobook. Yes. yeah. So check that out if you haven't already. And now it's time to discuss the viewer poll.
That was really interesting. I was watching the answers come into that all day long. It was just super cool.
And I will get it up on the screen. So, I forgot to take off that audiobook. I just wanted to leave it up forever. all right, so here is the poll. I'm gonna make it full screen so I can see a little bit better. So this, I actually stole this idea from the Pitch Wars account. Did a poll this week that was really similar, and that's run by Lee Marr. What do you primarily use to write first drafts? And I'm like leaning close so I can see it, and I need to turn my mic so you can still hear me. So we have 45% write it in Word, and we have
traditionalists.
Yeah, and then 34.7% in Scrivener, and 8% write paper and pencil or pen. mm-hmm. and 12% write in Google Docs.
Right.
And then we have a couple of people said they write in OneNote, so they can work from multiple devices, iPhone Notes / Evernote. And
Steve Downing's answer is just out of hand. It's amazing.
Hmm?
He writes, Steve Downey says he writes in revision controlled Git.
Yeah.
So he's writing in some high end stuff.
Yeah. I was like, I don't even know what any of these things are.
And then I refuse to choose.
Yes.
I mean, I do. I write in my journals. I usually outline in a plotting journal. I write in Scrivener. I can't always call that the first draft, but then I'll type it back through. Word is late. I don't do Word until much later. But even when, because I co-write things occasionally, and those get written in Google Docs,
mm-hmm.
because then you can sort of flip it back and forth.
Yeah. Yeah, I primarily draft in Scrivener, and then I do my first couple of rounds of revisions in Scrivener, and then I switch over to Word. But I've written some things in Google Docs,
mm-hmm.
especially if I'm in a situation where I need to be writing on multiple different devices.
Yeah.
And when I was a security guard, I was like a nighttime security guard when I was underemployed for a while, and I wrote, probably 23,000 words of Dragons or People 2 it was third shift and there was like no one there and just on my phone. Back then I had like a physical pullout keyboard on my phone too, which made it, I think, a little bit easier, but yeah. And I use that. I use Google Docs for that. Tamar said, I've been a social media outcast since Christmas and I missed the poll, but I am a Word girl.
Word girl. Sorry. Very PBS moment there.
My favorite thing about Scrivener, and the reason why, like the number one reason why I can't write in anything else, or I don't want to write in anything else, is the reference documents.
Mm-hmm.
So you can just have like a little thing over the side that has like character descriptions, or in my case, I write YA and I often put like class schedules in there.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, to try to do a little continuity, you know, and anything like that, like descriptions of people or like people are only mentioned a couple times, you know, like what was that person's name? So
there was a good, it's gone now, but there was a good question about writing retreats and how they help productivity. Yes, that one.
I think they can help, and I think also they can hurt too. And I think it depends on the people that you're with and their dedication to actually getting writing done. Because I've been to writing retreats where it's like people just want to chat for, you know, the whole time. But I've been to writing retreats where everyone gets down to business. And for me, it works. So I'm an extrovert, right? And so like I like the external pressure of other people being around me expecting me to write. And it kind of helps motivate me because I'm thinking, oh, these people know I'm supposed to be writing. And if I'm not writing, then that's embarrassing.
I find writer's retreats more useful if I go into them with a project and a goal rather than just sort of, oh, I'm going to go write. If I know what I'm working on and I know what I need to hit, that's useful. It's especially useful if everybody around me is also as goal-driven. I go to a couple writing retreats where there's a murder board where you put up how many words you've written that day, and you don't have to participate, but it's fun. And at the end, the person who has the most words gets prize. Casey Blair has often been the winner of that in some of the writing retreats that I've been on because Casey writes really fast. And I just think those can motivate as long as you sort of know what you're going in for. If you're going in for the social aspect, you're not going to get a lot of writing done necessarily unless there's a dedicated quiet space and you can kind of get yourself in there. It's useful also just to shake yourself out of a rut if you're in a rut. But if you're not in a rut and you're you know, jamming on the words, it's not necessarily a good place to go.
Yeah.
So it depends, like you said.
Yeah, I like the ones also that have like a bit of a structure where you can have some social time, but you don't let it control the weekend, you know. And whenever I do write-ins at the library, host monthly write-ins at the library, we do 20 minutes of writing time and 5 minutes of social time.
Nice. That's nice.
And 20 minutes is like, it's enough time that you get like a decent amount of work, but also not enough time that you get like sore sitting in your chair and, you know, so it's a nice little break, but yeah. All right. So the quote of the week, which is another thing that I just decided to do because I like quotes.
This is a great quote.
It made me laugh so hard. Where is human nature so weak as in the bookstore? Oh, and that has two R's. I should only have one R at the end of that name.
It's
that's
like
a typo. Yeah, it's funny. I'm a minimalist, but like, when I go to bookstores, I'm like, it's a struggle against.
I mean, I love
myself.
So many independent bookstores right now, but I found that the mug that I've been drinking out of all night is from Children's Book World. But it's just the way that they set up the store, and you want to walk through and explore all the sections and see what they have out and what they've got featured. Yeah, I never. It's really, every time I'm on tour with a book, I end up buying a lot more books and sending them home because they're so pretty.
Yeah, they are. All right. And so that's pretty much everything tonight. I did want to mention we're having a special extra episode next week. So we're actually going to have 3 episodes in a row. Because next week the special episode is going to be on, it's called Writers and Taxes, and it's going to be a live Q&A with a tax pro who is also an author. Her name is Mindy. I'm not sure how to pronounce her last name. I haven't looked it up yet. It's M-E-G-I-A.
Okay.
So Megia or Mahia, I'm not sure.
Perfect timing since it's tax season and also quarterlies are upon us and yeah.
Yeah, so I'm going to have some questions prepared for her, but then also anyone who tunes in is going to be able to ask questions, and I'll moderate them, and we will give preference to, like, questions that are helpful to multiple people rather than, like, very specific question that might only be helpful to you, because it's meant to be, like, kind of a learning and jumping off point, so you can learn some of the things that you might not know about taxes, especially because we have some new tax laws going into effect. They're going to change things. So, I was super excited. That was something I really wanted to do. And it just worked out that she was able to do it on a Saturday at the same time that I usually do episodes. So it's nice consistency there. Yeah. And then the episode after that on January 25th is going to be S.J. Jones, who is a New York Times bestselling author, and Patrice Caldwell, who is an author and a literary agent and a former editor.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so it's going to be a good episode. So make sure y'all come back next week and the week after that for those episodes.
This is a great way to spend a Saturday night.
Thank you. I think so. Fran, can you let us know what you have coming up and where we can find you online?
I have 3 things coming up. The biggest and most imminent of them is a cereal box series called Machina. And that is a race to build the AI robots that will help take us to Mars in sort of a crumbling universe. It is programming and office drama and 2 competing companies, one that is very corporate and one that is a little bit more deconstructed, and in between them is a bar called the Moonshot where everybody meets, and they're in competition to build these robots, and there's lots of secrets and lots of drama, really interesting characters. I helped develop this based on one of my favorite books about the origin of the PCs on the corridor in Boston called Soul of the New Machine. And it's sort of Soul of the New Machine meets The Right Stuff, meets The Office and Cheers with really smart, sarcastic robots. And my co-writers on that are Malka Older, who wrote Infomocracy, and Curtis Chen, who has been writing Ninth Step Station and also has Waypoint Kangaroo, and then a guest episode with Martha Wells, who wrote Murderbot. So it's really, really great. It starts on January 29th. You can pre-order it at Cereal Box. Please pre-order it. Cereal Box. The logo is gorgeous. I want to make stickers out of it. So that's happening. Anybody who is listening in, hit me up. I've got a 10% off code also. So for your listeners especially.
Cool.
And so that's happening in January. The next thing after that is I have a story coming out on tor.com in April. And there's a couple other things that are coming down the line. And we just wrapped Ninth Step Station season 2 for Cereal Box as well. And I am trying very hard to finish the Book of Gems so I can turn it into my publisher so that then the entire Gemworld series will be finished.
All right.
A lot of stuff happening.
Yeah.
So a couple of stories coming out as well.
Awesome. Yeah. And Fran's info, her website, Instagram, and Twitter is all in the description down below. So you can find Fran online in several different locations. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Fran, thank you so much for joining me. It's been so fun talking to you and getting to know you. And
thank you so much for having me. And I look forward to seeing you again, hopefully very soon.
Yeah. Ikfa.
Yes, at Ikfa.
All right. Well, have a good night.
Good night, and good night, everybody.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for watching. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to like and subscribe so you don't miss another episode. And make sure you tell your friends as well. That is how people find out about things like this. So that's kind of the best thing you can do to help support the show. Again, in the description, there's a place where you can subscribe via email and find us on social media. There's also a link to the Patreon. Thank you so much to my Patreon supporters. I really appreciate all the support and for you to continue supporting the show for months on end. It means a lot to me that I don't have to worry about like paying for the platform for the show and everything. So thank you so much. And the social media for the guests is in the description as well, along with the Pub Talk Live social media. So find us all on Twitter and Instagram and wherever else we are. I think that's it. Don't forget to tune in. Thank you so much for listening to this pre-recorded episode of Pub Talk Live. To find out more about the show and find out how you can watch live, go to pubtalk.live. Thank you so much to my Patreon podcast sponsors, Brenda Drake, Jay Lynn, and Reframe.